Kimberly Dark is a sociologist, a writer, and a performance artist, and she's coming to Western Michigan University as part of the annual Respecting Differences program. Dark is best known for her ability to talk about tough subjects like race and gender through storytelling that's both thoughtful and funny. And she's here with me on the phone. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi there.
So what are some of the topics that you really want to go over when you come to WMU?
Yeah, so, you know, it's kind of an oddity to be both a sociologist and a storyteller, but part of the reason that is the case, I mean, first of all, I came to realize early on that we're talking about really interesting, vital things in the social sciences, things like race and class and gender and all of the ways that appearance causes privilege in our culture or fails to cause privilege. But I also realized that no one will ever care about those magnificent things if we remain boring. And so that is, been my quest over the last couple of decades, is to try to use storytelling to talk about how privilege and oppression work in our daily lives. And basically, everybody already knows this stuff. It's just that you have to discover it for yourself in your own life. And so I use storytelling about my life. You know, it's not like I'm not an actor, right? These aren't characters that I'm developing. It's storytelling about my own life to help the audience think about their own lives as well, to help them reflect on, you know, where are the places that they withhold kindness from themselves and sometimes from others too.
You usually talk about a list of things, race, gender, sometimes obesity, things like that, and our standard of beauty. And one of the things that I found very interesting was the word parenting. You know, what about parenting? Talking about parenting can be scary.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not sure that talking about parenting itself can be scary, but our experiences, I mean, everyone has an experience being parented. I mean, whether or not that happened poorly or well, by your estimation, everyone has that experience. And many of us are also parents. I am, and I've found that that's, first of all, it's a place of connection, right? Because that's one of the reasons that I use storytelling, is to create intimacy and connection, and humor as well. You know, that's an important cornerstone, I think, to what I'm doing. Because you know what, if the audience is laughing, they're breathing. If they're breathing, then there's an openness to thoughtfulness and new information. So I think it's not so much that parenting is tough to talk about as it is that in our childhoods is the place where a whole lot of these ideas about race or class or gender or body size or sexual orientation, a whole lot of those, you know, we have formative memories from our childhoods. And often those come from our parents. So it's not so much to sort of say, oh, well, let's go back to the root of the root of the problem, like a psychotherapist or something, but to use those kind of stories to help us remember, oh, right, actually the social world is being created all the time by us, and we were handed a social world through our childhood experiences too. And maybe, you know, maybe parenting, too, is, you know, the way we currently parent, those of us who are parents, is good to talk about because that kind of gets us into how are we creating the next generation of values and ideals and practices.
Right. And you got your master's in sociology from Cal State San Marcos, isn't that right?
That is correct, and that is still where I teach in a graduate program in sociological practice. That university, you know, sociology programs are pretty well known for preparing sociology professors, right? There's not a whole lot of, you know, in the field of psychology, it's you can be a pop psychologist, right? But I've always kind of joked that I aim to be the first well-known pop sociologist there is, because it's a valuable perspective to be able to think about how the social world works as opposed to just always living in it. You know, the social world is a little like, you know, we're a little like fish trying to understand water. And so it's helpful to develop that perspective. And that is a program at Cal State San Marcos that is specifically preparing public scholars. And, you know, rather than preparing people to take professor roles at universities.
So did you know that that's what you wanted to do when you went in sociology? Or did you kind of develop this idea of performing as you were going through school? Talk about that process.
Sure. I mean, it's funny. I'm not sure that anybody who starts pursuing a degree in sociology really knows what they want to do. I'm not sure that that's, you know, because there's not a really super clear career path there. I did an undergraduate degree in sociology back in the 80s, and then I worked for a number of years in human services and in education. And so you know, I was a program administrator at a school district for a number of years. And then when I found this master's program, it was really kind of a revelation because I knew that I didn't want to be a full-time professor at a university, but this was really a fit for my interests in public scholarship and in public sociology. And so I got that degree, in the 90s. So there'd been, almost a 10-year break there. And for a number of years, I headed a social research consulting firm. The thing about storytelling was that it's part of my avocation as well as now being my vocation. But the thing about storytelling was that it evolved. You know, it's not as though I just sort of, went to university and thought, oh, yeah, why don't I do this? Nobody else is doing it. It evolved, and I put together my first full-length theater show in 1998. And people started asking, yeah, that was great. I did one show. And then people said, hey, can you do that again over here? And, pretty soon I was being invited to perform that show at various locations. And it became clear, oh, wait, something really important is happening here. This is working better to talk about these issues than just talking is doing. And now I do a combination of, kind of talking to the audience and telling stories. And, it's been about 15 years now that this is my work, other than just those few classes I teach at the university as well.
And you said that all of the stories come from your own experience. You know, how are you seen in society and how do you react to that?
Yeah, and that's exactly it, Rebecca, that all of us are carrying multiple identities. I mean, you can't help it, right? Everybody has at least one gender. Everybody has a sexual orientation. Sometimes that shifts throughout a person's life even. Everybody has an age, right? That's something that the privilege attached to age shifts for most of us if we live a long life. All of us have race, and race is a really interesting one because it's interpreted differently depending on who's looking, and I mean, that might sound strange, but travel outside of your own country and see how your race is, is interpreted somewhere else. It may be different. So all of us have these multiple identities that carry with them various privileges in different moments. And, the program that I'll be doing there in Michigan is really leading toward a simple... I'll just tell you the punchline now. How's that?
Oh,
it's,
all right.
it's leading toward something very simple, which is that kindness and awareness toward ourselves and toward one another can lead to cultural transformation. So, think about that. Like, can it really be that simple? I think in a sense it can because... each of us is creating the social world. Like, we don't wake up in the morning usually and think that, but I do, and I would like more people to think that way. That wow, we are actually powerful social creators. That the way we interact with our own identities, with our own bodies. I mean, just think about this. What kind of revolution would it be if every woman woke up tomorrow and decided not to hate her body for any reason, decided not to talk about her thighs disparagingly, or what kind of, you know, how much weight she'd like to lose, or what kind of way she'd like to sculpt herself. What if that were no longer on the agenda for anyone? It would literally change an entire culture. So obviously we can't synchronize that sort of thing in such a dramatic way. But it really does matter what kind of messages our children hear from us about our bodies. It matters how we interact with each other. You know, that every time two women order a dessert after a lunch, you know, that somebody's got to say, oh, well, I really shouldn't, or I don't deserve this, or I do deserve this because I was on the stair stepper, or just enjoy your dessert, ladies. So it matters how we talk and communicate with each other. So that's the simple punchline here. And, you know, we get to that through realizing that, oh, right, all of us, you know, we have these variable moments of privilege. When we can start noticing our own privilege, we can start extending privilege to others as well.
And before the interview, we were actually talking about how your first job was actually at your mother's finishing school. How did that an effect on your life?
I think it's had, so yes, our family business, you had asked me for a sound check to say something about my first job, and my first job was indeed in our family business. And I say it that way, family business, because, you know, when your parents are business owners, it kind of consumes the entire, you know, you're there when you need to be there. And that was the case for us. I went to the school every day after school for a long time and started working there. And yeah, it used to be called charm school, finishing school, but the idea that that women can practice, and then by the 80s, there were definitely men coming to those classes as well, but so that people can practice a certain comportment, a certain way of acting and being and appearing that will extend privilege to them. I mean, think about it. That's exactly what charm school, the idea is, that you can learn to look a certain way that is going to afford you greater, you know, greater privileges, greater resources in life. And it's absolutely true, you know, that it matters to learn how to play the appearance game. And the flip side of that being true is that if that becomes one of your main focuses in your life, you can live a pretty miserable life because there's a lot of stress involved in trying to conform one's appearance. As you know, this is why the fashion magazines and diet industry and, you know, all of these the surgeries, all of these things are multi-billion-dollar industries. So I think that having that awareness early on that, oh, right, we learn how to be, that it's not just inherent that you look a certain way, like that's not just biology, you know, all of us in society, we learn how to be. We may rebel against those lessons, but we all learn how to be. And so yeah, I think that influenced me a lot. And because I tell personal stories, you know, I do have, I have gotten some fodder for those stories from my early life experiences.
Back when we were talking about identities and how we all have multiple identities, what are your identities?
Yeah, well, you know, I talk about this a little bit in the program that I'll be doing there. You know, and I want to be clear about this too. Sometimes people say, you know, so this is like autobiography. I don't really see it that way. It's more like every story is about me, but I'm not the subject. The subject is always how do we create the social world? So I'm telling stories about my life that illustrate that. And my desire is that the audience at some point starts to think about their own stories about how they are creating the social world, so that by the time we've spent an hour together and then some Q&A, You know, ideally folks leave that auditorium feeling like, right, actually I am creating the world and there are things that I can do to take responsibility for my kindness to myself and my kindness to others. So back to your question, which was, what are my identities? You know, some of them are easy to see. Some of them are not so easy to see, like most people. Being female is easy to see in my case. Being queer, not so easy to see, right? Sexual orientation, because I am gender normative. That is, I look like a middle-aged woman, not like a scary dyke. You know what I mean? That's usually folks have a shared meaning on that. Like there's a certain way to look like a lesbian that folks seem to think they know when they look at someone what's happening. So I've already mentioned I'm middle-aged. I'm also fat. I have some beauty privilege nonetheless. You know, sometimes that's easy to see in looking at me, although being fat is one of the quickest ways to cancel out female beauty. we usually know that as well. I'm a mixed-race person, but I have white privilege, and I do talk about that in the performance too. I tell a story about how actually, in America, though we like to cling to the idea that, you know, somebody's Irish or somebody is Italian in their heritage, the fact that we live in a country that has a history of colonialism, of slavery, means that a lot of us don't actually know whether we're mixed race. And isn't that interesting that we tend to adhere so closely to the European heritage that we have. I'm also a parent and a professor. So these are, you know, these are some of my identities. Obviously some of them that I was given, some of them that I chose, like becoming a parent.
Right. You know, obviously these are difficult things to talk about. And, you know, I was kind of wincing when you said we're talking about your identities and more about how you are seen by other people versus, you know, how I might see you or someone else. You know, how can we start these difficult conversations on our own?
Yeah, well, my goodness. And that's why that business of the urge to wince, like for instance, when I use the word fat, I'm using it as a descriptor, just like someone might say a person is tall or a person is blonde. But isn't it interesting that the word fat, it's like there's an insult inherent in the word, right? And that's a big clue to us for how we, you know, how we think about and treat fat people in this culture. So there is, all of these topics can be really perilous, you know? And so, first of all, humor is very important. Right, because actually, when you get right down to it, this thing that we do, where we create the social world and then we cover up our tracks and act like no, it really is all just the way it is. Like that is really humorous when you start to unpack it. Like I don't, you know, I always tell people, it's like people go, oh my God, that's, you know, these stories are so hilarious, and I think, yeah, well, I don't need to write fiction. You know, there's no need to make things up because it's just absurd the way social life works. So I think each of us can do that. We can start to look for the humor in the way we create the world. We also can become aware that we're doing it. And literally, it is as easy as, you know, listening to, I mean, goodness, comedians do this as well, right? A lot of times comedians are in the business of saying, hey, do you ever notice that? You know how many jokes start out that way, right?
Right.
So we can do this. We can start to notice the absurdities of our daily lives, our social lives. And then the next step, though, which I think is very important, is to talk about them with each other in their seriousness. I mean, there's a reason that we laugh at that stuff, because sometimes laughing, you know, can soothe pain. But then the next step is to really go, yeah, wow, actually, you know, if I'm a guy and I'm, you know, we're laughing at the way gender norms work, at the end of that conversation, it's important to, you know, to look at for the man to look at his wife or his loved one and say, yeah, actually, that's not very funny, is it, that I feel okay walking home from this restaurant at night and you don't? Like, that's actually not funny, and, you know, how can we change that? So I think that is the thing. We get to that point by not feeling blamed, because that's always a danger, right? If I'm oppressed, then you're somehow the oppressor. And I'm not even sure that's how it works most of the time. Most of the time, we've created these systems that oppress people, and then all of us are just caught up in it, rather than, you know, being like an evil oppressor. So that's important, is to get to that part where we become allies in creating a better world, rather than, you know, there being finger pointing. Because my goodness, some people, if you just start talking about the concept of oppression, they go, whoa, whoa, you can't talk about that because I'm going to end up feeling bad. I think, you know, that's a mistake. We can reframe that.
Do you cater your performances to a specific audience? So, you know, what are some of the topics that you definitely want to go over with college students?
Right. Well, you know, college campuses are actually, I perform a lot at colleges and universities, and then also for conferences and businesses, and, you know, some of my shows are performed at theaters and festivals, and no one in the audience has any idea that I have a background in sociology. They're just there to be entertained, and I think that's fine. It's a good litmus for me, in fact, for a show to play solely as entertainment, because, you know, I mean, the content is all there, whether or not somebody knows they're being, you know, educated or not. So I'm actually doing, you know, three engagements while I'm there in Michigan. There's the Tuesday, Wednesday, but then there's also Friday night will be a different show at 7 p.m. At Western Michigan University. And that's open to the public. So that one was arranged by a student group, the LGBT group on campus. You know, I think the message for adults, as you say, versus college students are actually all the same, because none of us really were taught how to think about the social construction of the world. None of us were, because, you know, we tend to, as I mentioned earlier, right, there's, like, we know what a pop psychologist is, but the idea of a pop sociologist is humorous, because we tend to personalize problems. We tend to think, you know, oh, well, if somebody is, you know, I don't know, if somebody feels depressed because of how they look, it has to do with a personal, you know, tendency toward depression. We don't immediately think, oh, well, how is that person oppressed? What is their position in society, you know? So because none of us were taught to think that way, I feel like, you know, the dual purpose is entertainment and also, hey, take a separate view here. Take another view. And that's the same for, you know, people who are out living their lives and working their jobs, as it is for people who are at university.
Well, I think that's all that I had. Is there anything that we didn't talk about or that you just wanted to mention?
Wow, I'm not sure. It's my pleasure to be able to come and spend you know, almost a week there and get in, like I mentioned, three shows. If anybody's interested in learning more about the work I do, it's KimberlyDark.com, KimberlyDark. And I am available to folks. I mean, I write for Huffington Post and for Ms. Magazine blog and a number of places. So I'm quite available on the web. You can befriend me on Facebook. So, you know, if any of this is of interest and you can't get to the show, please connect another way.
Great. Well, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Sociologist and performer Kimberly Dark will be at Chenery Auditorium Tuesday, March 25th, and that following Wednesday, as well as at Western Michigan University on Friday at 7:00.